Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm very happy to have as my guest Carlos Ruiz Zafón, the author, most recently, of The Angel's Game. It's published by Doubleday. He's the author, as well, of the immensely popular The Shadow of the Wind. And this book is, in a sense, a predecessor to The Shadow of the Wind, in that one of the major characters in The Shadow of the Wind is born just as The Angel's Game concludes, though the books don't really need to be read together. They can be read entirely separately. Once again, the author strikes one as being a kind of magus figure, a magician. And I'm curious, for you, that writing wizard, who is he? Where does he come from?
Well, I don't know. To me, the writing thing, the writing bug or whatever that is that resides in my brain comes from as far as I can remember. Everything I've always done has been to make up stories and telling them. I remember since I was a child what I've been doing. Even before I could learn to read and write, I was kind of making up stories, character worlds. And as soon as I could get them on paper, I started doing so. So this is what I've always been doing. I've been always writing and always been fascinated by storytelling, by a language, by all these codes, all these things that you can use to tell stories, to communicate ideas, to explore the world of the mind. And so I guess in many ways I had no choice. I was born like this. It came from the factory settings. You know, it's the motherboard that got installed in my brain, and this is what I have. So I knew from a very early age that this is what I was going to do. I was going to be a writer. I was going to make a living doing this.
The hero of The Angel's Game, David Martin, he's the son of a porter at the newspaper offices, and he's worked as an assistant. But it turns out that he has a gift for writing. It's recognized by Pedro, whom he works for, and eventually by the managing editor. But what do you think such a gift consists in?
I think there are, you know, I think sometimes we are born with certain gifts, with certain talents. And then we are all born with something. We have abilities. You know, our brains are similar. They have similar capabilities. But for some reason, some people are wired in a certain way. And I think we all have these capabilities to do something. We have more facility to understand certain things or to learn certain things. And I think in the case of the writers, writers are connected to language, to ideas, to creating structures that communicate things. I think this is what the mind of a writer is. It's about communication. It's about language. And I think, because in many ways, I think language is the software of the mind. We think in narrative structures, and evolutive psychology teaches us that we learn in narrative structures as well. We don't learn from raw data and from facts. We actually learn through these narrative structures. This is how we assimilate knowledge. This is how we theorize. This is how we express things. And this is how we articulate things. As a matter of fact, whatever we can articulate through some kind of language, be the language of mathematics, science, or literature, or music, we cannot really express or understand because our minds are based on language. And I think that writers do is are extremely connected to this primal thing in human nature in our brains. And explore it or use it to explore their own world, to understand the world, and do so in something that comes, I think, also from Mother Nature, which is creating up stories. It's a way to understand the world, ourselves, and others through stories. I think this is a natural impulse. And if we develop that and we follow that, and then we try to learn it as a craft and try to develop our skills, eventually we start writing stories or telling them in different formats. And I think this is how writers are formed, because we're exploring something that's already inside of us, but we develop. In many ways, I think it's like with athletes. Athletes are born with certain physical capabilities, but that by itself, it's nothing. You know, you develop that, and then you may become an athlete because you're developing something that is given to you. I think it's the same case with writers.
I think so, too. Now, the writer in this case, David Martin, develops a writing muscle. He is writing first a serial for the newspapers and then a series of books called City of the Damned. By his arrangement, his name is not on them, and he is writing late into the night, almost in a, before meeting the devil, yeah, a diabolical pact, mm-hmm, with lawyers, publishers, and their contracts.
Uh-huh.
And eventually, he's given the opportunity, because he has developed such extraordinary skills, and he says, in fact, that the creation, mm-hmm, of a character is not a matter of emotional temperament, it's a matter of skill, it's a matter of technique. So naturally, let us say the devil is attracted to him.
Mm-hmm.
The devil, as usual, is unfailingly polite,
mm-hmm,
and David has made himself sick by his...
He's been burning his life and his youth and his health writing these kind of anonymous penny dreadfuls. He's been working for a couple of pirate publishers writing these books in a feverish state, but he cannot even put his name on them. And so essentially he's burning himself. He's trying to survive. He's always been, since childhood, he loses his father. He's abandoned by his mother. So his circumstances have been extreme. And little by little, though he doesn't know, he's being pushed toward this meeting with these mysterious characters, this diabolical publisher that wants to hire him, because actually he feels he's an extraordinary writer, and he wants to hire him for his skills, for a project that is entirely very sinister and very strange.
Now, I'm curious... I love the kind of devious and winding storytelling that is called the penny dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
And I also love it high and low. I love Eugene Sue as much as I love the manuscript found in Saragossa.
Yeah.
Where do you place your own work?
I try to use all of it. I think one of the things I'm also kind of fond of the genre. And sometimes I like to pick up these lost causes. I think the penny dreadful is one of those genres that traditionally is always vilified or scandalizes people or offends people because it can be kind of outrageous or over the top, but it has these elements of grand guignol. And traditionally it has been always some kind of subversive thing, always a mockery of the conventions of literature or publishing. It's always a mockery of the snobbery and things like that. And I think it's a good cause to pick. And I think, you know, if I'm going to pick a genre to reinvent, to reconstruct, and to deconstruct and play around and experiment with that, why not that? I think because in many ways, especially because the figure of the narrator, David Martin, this writer, has much of homage to these great professional writers of the 19th century. We were constantly bordering there on the penny dreadful, on these serials written week by week, published in magazines, in newspapers, in which they had to fight for their audience. They had to seduce them. They had to take all the tricks in the bag. And they were creating these masterpieces through this really kind of the routines of extreme commercial writer from Balzac to Dickens. I've always been fascinated by these people, and I wanted this character and this book to be an homage to this tradition, because sometimes I feel that we have kind of lost the notion that these great masterpieces were the popular fiction of their time. They were not obscure things that were the Penguin classics with introductions by very booky professors. No, actually, it was the popular fiction. So I wanted to go back into the penny dreadful, into these big Victorian gothics with a lot of murders and intrigues and some kind of labyrinthine plots.
Now, the form that you're using, which bears traces of the Victorian novel, but also of the road novel of rogues and adventure. When it's been adapted to our times now, it's been usually highly literary writers, but to my mind, very enjoyable. John Fowles, say, or John Barth. And you, it seems, want to make a distinction between the popularity of the form and these highly literate novels. And yet The French Lieutenant's Woman, for instance, was mm-hmm. very popular. I would say as popular as any Victorian novel ever was. Mm-hmm. Do you distinguish really between the literary effort and the popular effort?
I tend to. I think there are distinctions that are dangerous because I think they invite prejudice. I think sometimes they invite snobbery. And sometimes they make us lose the big picture. And to me, my main distinction, to me, it's good writing and bad writing.
Yes, I agree.
And I tend not to pay much attention to a lot of these labels or distinctions, or especially think one of the greatest frauds sometimes of the 20th century is the invention of the highbrow and the lowbrow. I always saw that some kind of a strange marketing device to push and peddle specific things or to create prejudices and to manipulate opinions of readers, of people, about how you're selling them, or you should like this or you should not like this. And essentially, when at the end of the day, to me, it comes all about craft. And if something is well-crafted, is well-done, is well-written or not. And sometimes you find extraordinarily good work written as dramas, as some kind of moving playwright thing, and television, and say, well, yeah, that's what it is, you know. And it's sitting next to tons of horrible reality television crap. And then you have these jewels of drama and writing, and they're wonderful. And that's what they are. And you find fantastic writing sentence in genre fiction. Especially, I would say, if you go back to the last 20, 25 years, a lot of the great professional writing, it's more usually found in genre fiction, in crime thrillers, in science fiction, in fantasy, in horror, than in mainstream literary fiction, which a lot of quite often feels kind of bland and empty and seems, what is exactly the point of this? So I think you have to be careful, or try to be. And as a reader, I'm always... I try to write widely and ignore all these labels and prejudices. I think I would rather decide for myself. And what I'm instantly interested in is in good writing. And I find it in very different places. And I don't care what's the label attached to that. Mm-hmm. I understand that label centers are necessary because you need to differentiate. And then at the bookstores, they need to put one thing in place. Okay, that's fine. And it's a way sometimes to try to organize things. Otherwise, it would be very confusing. But I think we also need to be made aware that these are just arbitrary distinctions. There are criteria we use to put some things up, but the main point of it is, you know, good writing. It's the art of fiction, the art of the language, of storytelling, and that can be found anywhere. And this is the way I see. So I try not to. I think that, you know, when we go back to most of the classics of literature, they were the popular fiction of their day.
I think they still are.
And they still are. And quite often when we see a lot of the stories that are relevant to our culture, to our times, they are still the popular fiction of our days. And it seems like it's a sin that if it's popular, it cannot be good. And then you have to wonder, well, who's saying those things? Mm-hmm. What is the personal agenda? What are the interests behind this type of things? The people who are trying to enforce a strange kind of thought police that somebody's trying to tell us what we should think, what we should consider good. It's just like, because we are idiots, we cannot decide for ourselves. One of the things I'm trying to communicate to readers is this invitation to critical thought. You know, think for yourself, decide for yourself. We have a brain between our ears, you know, and that's a lot of the point of reading and exploring literature is about that, about using that brain to enjoy, to find beauty, to find intelligence, to find ideas. So let's use it. And then we'll be able to decide. We'll decide that sometimes there are popular things that are fantastic and then sometimes there are not. But, hey, let's use that brain of ours and not take this kind of reheated, mysterious opinions that are being enforced that rarely, very rarely, they make any sense. And usually they are transparent and they are masking agendas that are more than suspicious.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Carlos Ruiz Zafón, author of The Angel's Game, published by Doubleday. We'll continue after this short break. Thank you. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Carlos Ruiz Zafón about The Angel's Game. In the heart of both books, both The Angel's Game and The Shadow of the Wind, which are the two books so far translated into English by my guest Carlos Ruiz Zafón, one discovers that the events of the present are a recreation of a set of events in the past, sometimes involving the same family, but sometimes involving a whole different set of characters. But the sense is that somehow or other, as in a DNA chain, some form is being replicated through time. And as the characters become aware of this, they become aware of their fate. These elements, which truly do come from popular fiction, you know, and going back to the sins of the fathers shall be visited on the sons, what have you, ancient perception, but they do lead to philosophical questions. Is history repeating itself as farce or as tragedy? Mm-hmm. We've seen two generations now of this set of novels, and to know that the hero of the next is born at the end of this one, part of it is the thrill of being involved in a structure larger, much larger than the reader or the character, and being like someone trapped on a rock face, trying to intuit the size of the cliff. I think that the books, whoever is reading them, the effects that they have on any reader are literary effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things, I always think that I'm writing for people who like to read.
Yes.
For all sorts of people, and people who like to read very different things, and for people that are also aware of many of the elements of the storytelling, of the classic themes of literature, that enjoy these things, that want to see them reinvented, that want to play around with these things that are part of their lives, and I want to play with those. And in many ways, some things come from popular fiction, but some of the classic themes are always, it's not that I'm inventing anything new, I'm going back to the classic themes of literature that we can find in everything, and from Shakespeare to Cervantes to Dickens to nowadays a lot of popular novels. And these are themes, is what the novel of the 19th century was called, the great book of life, all these elements that are there, and we keep on enjoying because I think they appeal to our nature.
It's implied that the devil keeps a photograph wall of his triumphs. And indeed, as we go through the narrowing funnel of the end of the novel, one after another of the characters we've come to know dies, and one assumes that his photo will then appear on what we no longer mm-hmm. see, the devil's mm-hmm. wall of souvenirs. Leaving us, finally, at the end of the book, with an unidentified photo, that of a man leading a young woman, a young girl, on a pier into the mist. This image has haunted the novel throughout, and it's as if the book is being swallowed into the final image.
It is, in many ways, and this has to do with the nature of these stories. There's something about both The Angel's Game and The Shadow of the Wind that preceded it that is part of a bigger picture. These are two stories inside a cycle of four novels that I plan to finish that are interdependent. They're standalone stories. You could read The Angel's Game, know nothing about Shadow of the Wind. It works perfectly on its own. But if you read one or more of these stories, you start seeing these connections. They all are a quartet of stories that forms a kind of labyrinth of fictions with four doors of entry. Ideally, you would be able to walk through any of these four doors in any order you want and read one or two or all the books in any order you want. And the puzzle would rearrange in front of you. What happens now is that, of course, the Angel's Game, in many ways, although it's not necessarily a sequel because the storyline doesn't pick up where Shadow of the Wind ends, or not necessarily a prequel because although, yes, the story precedes the main action of Shadow of the Wind, there are many elements that don't necessarily lead into that. They are parallel stories. They intersect at this cemetery of forgotten books through certain character scenes at different points in their life. But the idea is that the Angel's Game is more of a second act. And second acts are where the plot thickens, where everything is darker, where everything is complicated, and we get really down the rabbit hole before we see the light at the end of the tunnel. And right now what is going on is that, of course, at the end of the Angel's Game, we get that we're really being sucked into this rabbit hole and say, oh my God, what the hell is going on here? We'll know, and we'll... All these unsolved questions, so to speak, or all these things that pop into our mind by the conclusion will be answered. And will be answered in a way in which I don't think the reader anticipates. There's going to be surprising and hopefully exciting in the future as these four stories keep growing. So that's a little... And I know that that's one of the things about the Angel's Game, because one of the things that was very interesting in doing here is, you know, if Shadow of the Wind is a book especially about readers... This is more a book about writers, about the writing life, about the process of a storytelling. And the main difference is that Shadow of the Wind is essentially a novel that does all the work for you. You just sit back and enjoy and relax. The Angel's Game is a more aggressive book in the sense that it forces the reader to become part of the storytelling process. It provides, as you get deeper into the plot, you enter the skin of this main character, and you start questioning if he's an unreliable narrator, or you start interpreting different things. And you can interpret the novel in many different ways. You can interpret it as a big gothic Victorian supernatural thriller. You can interpret it as a purely psychological intrigue. You can as a fable. You can interpret it in many different ways, and all of those things click. So what is interesting to me is to create a story in which the reader becomes a part of the story. And depending on what's your baggage, depending on who you are, these hollow mirrors are going to return a different image to you, a different meaning.
Interestingly, the writer of The Angel's Game, David Martin, is asked by the devil to create a religion. And we can say in the tradition of popular fiction, testaments, religious narrative, are the most popular fiction
of all
the
time.
World has ever known.
Yes.
And, as we see in recent years, one of the most dangerous. I was wondering whether those implications were going to be explored in the subsequent books.
I think some of them are. I think one of the dangers in when you're talking about religion or dogmatic thought, which is one of the issues that the Angel's Game tries to take, and not just religious thought, but dogmatic thought in general, ideological, political, nationalistic, whatever, all these systems of beliefs that we tend to generate and we tend to use to justify our actions, etc., and organize systems of ethics and societies and so on. And one of the dangers is trying to convince the reader that your own take is right. And then you become a dogmatic preacher yourself, and you're just trying to battle other dogmas. So one of the things I was trying to do is invite the reader to consider, to think about those things, but never being dogmatic about them, arguing different points of views and arguing all of them honestly. And even though some of them were points of view that I did not believe, but I would argue them honestly and try to bring all these elements into the table to invite the reader to consider this thing, because I think that, as you will point out, this is an extremely timely issue. The nature of dogmatic thought, why we believe the things we believe, how we organize, justify the things we are doing, our conduct, our societies, all based on systems of beliefs that are sometimes based on the supernatural or an assumption or organizations that are administering all these systems of belief, and they're shaping them and deforming them into. I think it's an extremely timely issue. It goes to the nature of the world we are living in, and this is one of the most important issues and elements in The Shadow of the Wind. Although the story tries to take the form of a thriller, an adventure, and a romance, of course there are underlying themes, and this is one of the most important, the nature of dogmatic thought. And in the case, this Diabolica character, this publisher from Paris, wants to hire a talented writer of popular fiction to create a book that is going to be the foundation of one of the most popular forms, a religion, a mythology. Something that, and I say, well, who wants to create a mythology? It's actually this diabolical guy. And he's finding somebody whose specialty is form. Is skill. He's not interested in what he believes in. Say, you know, and at some point he said, "We are professionals. We aren't going to talk about beliefs. We are not concerned about that. We're concerned about results, about technique, how to create ideas and forms and stories that convince and seduce people to believe in things and to act in certain ways, and to use a lot of elements in our nature and our biology to transcend that and be articulated into strange systems of beliefs that can justify anything." I think this is an extremely fascinating issue, and I was very concerned on not trying to be preachy on that or trying to be critical or try to write a critique of religion or of political thought. No, it's just invite the reader to consider these issues in an open way, in an honest way, and say, what does it mean to you? And try to get to the bottom of the mechanisms of these systems of belief and try to talk about them. And then I think the most interesting things and the conclusions is what the reader thinks about all that, not what I try to take the reader into in a specific way, or this is true or this is not true. And I think, because I think that always fails, and I think what is interesting is just to invite the reader to think freely.
I've been speaking with Carlos Ruiz Zafón, author most recently of The Angel's Game, his earlier novel The Shadow of the Wind. They were both published by Doubleday. Thank you, Carlos, for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Angel's Game at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Nights were bold in books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
You laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend. Hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.